Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an x-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Sean.
I am Ed.
And I'm Sharon.
And today on the show, we are talking about season 4, episode 17, A Bloody Mess. How is everyone today?
Bloody mess, thank you. Sorry, that's all I could think about. I just thought, gosh, this is such a British title.
it does sound like proper sort of northern, like, oh, he's a bloody mess, that one. Yeah, or doing, oh, it's a bloody mess in here.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I am a mess, but not bloody, so.
But good, glad to hear it. Glad
as usual.
It does sound like they asked Alex Kingston, it was stuck for a name for this one. What do you reckon?
It's a bloody mess.
Maybe that's what she said when she read the script. Oh, this is a bloody mess. And I'm like, hang on a minute. Although I say that, I do like this episode.
Yeah,
but yeah this is not a bloody mess, but there you go.
My first thing about this one is that, and again, spoiler, but we've talked about this before, it's like, I wanted Anna for more than one season. I like her in this episode. I like her pretty much in every one of her episodes, but I like her in this because Maria Bello just, also, spoiler, I'd like to cover Anna first, if you wouldn't mind terribly. Because she has a kind of
who contained does she think story she is? As well.
I think I'm a one season guest star, Ed.
I agree. I completely agree. I absolutely love, and I remember when I first watched ER and it introduced me to her as an actress, and I remember just being like, God, I love her. She's just so kick-ass. She doesn't come in as anybody's girlfriend or wife, or, you know, she's just this woman who comes in. She's strong, she's independent, she's been through stuff, but she works hard and she's just so easy to watch. That's what I find about Maria Bello.
Very welcoming, something in the way that she presents herself, like even when, like, we've seen her angry, sure. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I'm perhaps there are several great performances where she plays a villain out there, but I don't know if I could see her as a villain. She just seems like someone who just always has your back.
Yeah.
I want to Google that, but I'll do it later. It's funny because I've sort of talked about the things that the first time I watched it, you know, when it first aired in the UK on Channel 4, some things stuck in my head. So things like Carter going, that's where we're going to go, so that's what we're going to do, whatever, during the benzene episode. And she stuck in my head so clearly, but I can't remember very much from back then, but she did stay in my head. I did get her mixed up with, the one who gets stabbed.
Lucy.
Lucy Knight.
In my head, I did conflate the two a little bit. But Maria Bello stuck
all
in my
blonde
head.
White women look the same to Ed.
Well,
I mean, I could say worse things, but which aren't true, and I'm not going to dig myself a hole.
Yeah.
Sorry
that from the record. But yeah, I remembered her from that point. And to say, as you say, she was in one season, and when I first watched it, it was, you know, the 1990s. That shows what an impression she left.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I totally agree. Having said what I literally just said, I didn't remember her so much on my first watch, way back when, because I think I said a few times is that it was on in the house, but my memories of ER start with Kovac.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
So,
mine.
Oh, don't worry. That's fine. Yeah, exactly. I will disappear from the pod roughly midway through season 5. Put it that way. Good luck, I guess.
He's going to head off to Seattle. Is that what you're going to be doing?
I will just see how everyone is. I understand. So her storyline in this is that a couple come in and they are expecting. They are parents who are expecting, as opposed to expecting their parents.
And that'd be weird to be
that would be strange. And the expectant mother she's had several miscarriages, she's not well, the pregnancy is taking a real rough toll on her body, and she is initially reluctant to take medication, and it has all the hallmarks for a, you know, kind of like, are you kind of anti-medicine here, people? And it absolutely flips the script, which I wasn't expecting. And this is what I mean, like, her storyline is quite short this week, is that
it is, yeah.
She is looking after, she speaks to this woman about you know, kind of her options, and she heavily recommends taking a certain medication. Yes, it will put the baby at risk, but her own declining health status, the mother's, is putting the baby at risk. So it's literally the lesser of two evils.
Right? I think that's such an interesting point, though, because I think that a lot of people think, oh, I'm not good. I don't know why medicine's got a bad rap. You know, it's the same thing of being like, oh, chemicals in your body that you don't. And it's like, it's not that at all, you know. And anyway, but the idea that I'm not going to do anything because I want my baby to be 100% organic and natural and all this. And it's like, okay, understood. But also on the other side, like you say, if she passes away, that baby's not going to make it. You know, if she's not giving the baby nutrients or not being able to keep food down, or, you know, that baby's gonna suffer from all of that. And it's just, it's so interesting how people don't seem to be able to weigh things up. I don't know. And also the fact that medicine isn't, you know, doctors and medicine aren't here to hurt you. They're trying to help you. The reason we have moved on in life, you know, is because of it. Sorry, Sean, I jumped in there and just
not at all. No.
Please continue.
I thank you, but no, this is a collaborative podcast. We enjoy speaking to you. It's totally fine. But yeah, no, it's Ed is there shaking his nose.
It wasn't meant to be broadcast. It was just like a little visual joke.
We have no secrets from our listeners, Ed. No. You know that.
Don't we?
Now, while I'm on that topic, here's Ed's bank account details.
I was just going to say, you know, with the talk about the anti-signs and want my children to be 100% organic, well, like, not have intervention. So how far does that extend? Yeah. So they're not allowed to have electricity to see around, and they're not allowed to use fire to cook food.
Wear clothes because you weren't born with clothes. You
know? They were made by a sewing machine at some point, possibly.
Yes, yeah, I agree. And also, we have to develop. The world is developing, then you should develop with it. I've always just really struggled with people who are like, oh, I can't, I'm not doing that, or I'm not giving injections, or I'm not doing that because, you know, that's not God's plan, or I don't know, or whatever. I want to be, everything has to be natural or whatever, because that's not life, you know. Nothing is natural, and sometimes natural stuff, you know, isn't always good for you. You know, you can scream about natural, but
botulism, that's pretty bad.
Exactly. That's, if I started, you know, feeding mistletoe berries to people, you know, they're gonna die. So
don't do that.
Don't eat mistletoe berries.
It's wouldn't
recommend.
Just the last thing. A famous person, I'm not going to name names or anything, said that they disagreed with vaccines because it was an alien organism entering the body. And I was like, that is, oh my God, there are so many instances where our cells have been invaded by other organisms, and it's had either a positive effect or no real effect. Like our genome is part virus. Viruses have altered our genome for millennia, for millions of years. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. And
that's the end of my TED talk.
We love to hear it. Thank you very much. Now, here's the switch in the episode.
Yes.
The father comes out, and he is straight for the jugular with Anna. And we, as an audience, are like, what? Hang on. She's like, the last thing we saw is she was advising the expectant mother to take medication to get well, so that, you know, it would give her baby the best chance of survival. And he comes out, I should have known once I saw your name, you're Catholic, aren't you? And I have to say, I was totally blindsided by this.
Me too. I didn't get where that was coming from a little bit.
Because all the way through the episode, I guess what he's been, the wife has been very much, do everything you can to save this baby, this baby, this baby. Whereas he seems, you know, he says to Anna, actually, make sure you save her first, don't do anything. And the way medicine is that they would always treat the mother before they treat the baby anyway. So, you know, that is totally against doctors' orders to kind of go, right, we're going to do whatever we can to save the baby. But you're right. She says, actually, if it was me, I would take the medication. At no point has she said, you can't have it, you can't do this. And it felt really, you know, he obviously was angry and maybe a little bit prejudiced. I don't know. Maybe he was just panicking. But yeah, he just comes out and attacks her and says, it's because you're Catholic. And she's like, yes, I'm Catholic and I'm a woman and I'm this and I'm that. But, you know, it's not any of those things. Yeah, it was, as you say, it was not expected at all. You think he might be a bit more like, yeah, save the baby, or I don't know, let's not have drugs or whatever.
It's like he was suggesting that she's not allowed to abort the baby if it hurts her. But I'm like, that was never on the table.
No. And at no point has she kind of gone right. You're going to do this and this for the baby, but forget you, kind of, you know, at no point was she saying you have to keep the baby. She was very much like, you have to look after you, therefore the baby can come along. But it's interesting, it comes up a few times in ER, the religious thing, and oh, you're religious, therefore you've given me this advice. And I don't know, I feel like we can really trust them to separate things.
But did Doyle get into this? I can't remember what happened, but she's very
anti-abortion.
I remember that episode. A socially conservative line about something along those lines, and she called the police because she wants an abortion or something along those lines.
Oh, yes, that person. Yeah, she was like, wanting to kill her baby. That's why she kind of
killed her. That's it. Yeah, thank you.
I mean, Doyle is a bit of a, I find Doyle like tough character to like personally.
Yes.
Good job she's not in it much.
Yeah, she acts before she even thinks and has time, whereas I feel like all the other doctors, you know, and I think if you're going to become a doctor, hopefully, you know, you're hopefully able to separate them. I don't know, but at no point did Anna come in, you know, waving her cross and, you know, reading scripture and saying anything about the baby. So I just think, he was probably just a really very angry dad. But
exactly. And and he's, I don't know, he's worried for everything. Like, this is where, obviously, please don't ever attack your doctor verbally or physically.
yes, you know, definitely.
Like, seek a second opinion by exactly
self defense. Yeah,
of course. Oh, by all means, seek second opinions. Of course, that's not. Mm-hmm. There's no problem with that. But you know, he comes out bullying, and she handles it beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Like, arguably, not even you have. There is a tiny. It's not even a crossover, but she's standing beside Carter, and of course, we know he's had about 4 seconds of sleep since last week. So he kind of starts to go, hey, and she goes, shush.
I'm fine.
I don't need help. Thank you very much. And she perfectly calmly, you know, speaks to the man. And I wouldn't say he gets to the point of understanding or even, but he does kind of like, maybe I came out looking for a fight and I didn't find one.
Yes.
I agree. And he actually... I was just going to say, he needs to talk to his wife. It's not Anna. He's got a very different view to his wife. And that's where the conversation needs to happen. Not so much with Anna, but
It's a short story for Anna this week. And perhaps, to be honest, perhaps that's one of the reasons Maria Bello left. It's like, you're giving me a scene per episode.
And it's also sort of still related to her being Catholic rather than her as a whole character. Do you know what I mean? It's
king on the female,
Catholic
woman. I don't know, that's Anna's story in this, I guess.
Basically, we're like three minutes into the podcast, so that's Anna. another, to be honest, not that I'm trying to get them out of the way or anything, but another short storyline is Carrie and Morgenstern, who's back this week.
Yeah, Morgenstern's back. To be honest, I'd forgotten about him until he walked back in. I was like, you
work here.
I thought he had left. I won't lie.
And maybe that's kind of the desired effect, the idea that Kerry is so good and so capable that we all just moved on without him. But yeah, he's come back, hasn't he? And he says he wants to work in the trenches to kind of get himself back to, you know, back into the swing of things, I guess. And straight away Kerry's stressed because she's like, I haven't prepared your handover anymore. And he's just like, it's fine, it's chill, I just want to be here. But also, I really like this storyline because it really starts one way, which is where he's been quite, it changed me, man, you know, I've been,
he's
changed,
very zen, isn't he? He's,
yeah, everybody's got a story and you think, oh no, this is the start of him sitting for 7 hours, you know, with each person and going, no, I'm not going to do that. And there are moments of that where he's been spending a long time with people and writing a lot of stuff down, but it goes down a different route than I expected, but yeah.
Yeah, he brings all those cakes in. I don't know if they're muffins or some kind of loaf or something. Gives everybody a hug.
Yeah, I know.
Which is, considering his position, a little bit odd.
Yes.
I did think it was a bit, yeah. And yeah. Like I quite like William H. Macy as an actor. Now, he does tend to play quite similar, which is fine. It's a bit like, no judgment. You don't hire Jack Nicholson to play Meryl Streep. You know what I mean? Like, you hire particular actors because you want what that actor does.
Oh, but Meryl could play Jack Nicholson in a heartbeat, couldn't she?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To absolutely paraphrase Modern Family for a second. Sorry, Meryl Streep is never the wrong choice. Meryl Streep could be cast as Batman and still be the right choice. You know,
I'd watch it.
I'm thinking about that. Yeah,
I'd watch her Batman anyway. 100%. Yes,
she basically played Trump in that Netflix movie, which is great.
Indeed.
Oh, yeah. Don't Look Up.
Yeah. Oh, so good.
But sort of, long story medium, Morgenstern came back way too early.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's that scene, a guy's been, a gunshot wound victim has been brought in. Doyle's noticeably absent. Just going to put that out there. And at no point did they explain how it happened. But anyway, mm-hmm. You know, he comes in and Morgenstern flakes completely. You know, he just can't hold anything straight. He can't do the actual what he needs to do. And he ends up walking out and Corday's like, you know, who was that? Like, she's obviously never met him, you know.
He freezes, says, I've got something in my eye. I need to step out.
Yeah.
It's like,
This was one of the first times I can remember watching ER where, say, like, a new character had come in contact with an old character who we all know.
Yeah.
And, you know, this kind of like, oh, who the hell was that? You know?
Yeah.
I know it will happen, I think, more as the years go on. Now, particularly as we go into the last season, it's like every other episode. You know, we have,
hang on, you're back. And everyone's like, we don't know who Benton is. You know, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they didn't
exactly.
bring Randy back.
Should have, although anyway. She should own the hospital by that point.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Spoilers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're doing it under county general. Sorry, I believe you mean Randy General.
So he then kind of disappears, doesn't he? And I think everybody's a little bit worried about him.
Yeah.
Carrie finds him. He's kind of gone down to what I imagine is the school where people can practice. So they've got cadavers and things, and he's kind of practicing. And they have a little bit of a debate, don't they, about kind of learn, because Morgenstern's very much like, you can learn a lot about somebody and know how to treat them. And Kerry's very much, you treat what's in front of you. You know, knowing this guy had a dog when he was 7 is not going to help me sort out his appendix, you know. And this is where I mean, it feels like we were being led down this kind of, he was going to end up not being able to do any procedures anymore, and B, being too hippie-ish about it all, and being very too thoughtful and getting a bit too wistful and things like that.
Just on that, because picking up on that exactly, I think this episode is a good example for, and we've discussed this before, of the OR versus the ER. Of the OR is you're a cadaver whether you survive or not,
mm-hmm.
and the ER is a bit, like, if Morgenstern, the way he's acting now, is the ER on speed, you know, it's a bit like, you know, it doesn't really matter that he had a dog when he was 7 and he outlived his children. But what they do care about is, like, you know, hey, are you okay? Because generally, not always, but generally you're awake when you get into the ER.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this episode seems to come down on the, you kind of need to not get that too attached to your patients. Because this could end up, well, first of all, it could affect patient care, which it sort of does.
Mm-hmm.
And it also answered a question I didn't realize needed answering. Kerry doesn't waste, or like Kerry, who we know is very good with patients and she's very good at engaging, doesn't sweat the backstory.
No.
And that was very interesting to discover in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to, at some point, think of them kind of as a piece of meat, and that's maybe when Morgenstern froze, because it's like, if I make the wrong cut, if I do the wrong thing, if I'm cutting into this man's chest and he's run his shop for 75,000 years or whatever, do you know, whatever it is, I'm affecting this guy's life. And I guess you have to be able to remove yourself from that and go, but I, you know, it doesn't matter because I need to make this cut to get the bullet out or do whatever.
Yeah.
And I think as well, I started a thought and it jumped right back out of my head. So continue on as you were.
That's right. It'll come back.
It'll come back. It'll be seven episodes from now, but it will come back.
Yeah.
Morgenstern.
Do you remember that?
I've got something from last week that I've only just worked out. So I might talk to you about that later. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
The next time we see Morgenstern, he's back up in the ER and he's a tiny little bit shorter with people. Not by much, just tiny little bit. And then suddenly someone is coding and it's like, if Morgenstern, now Kerry's there as well. It's like, if Morgenstern is nearby, that man is in no particular better position than he was if he was out in the car park. And so they go in and the way it's framed, it's that this man has been given, I think it's bicarbonates to help break down something in his system that is now causing a gas to start expanding. Yes. And the way it's shot, it does look like the poor man's stomach is a bit, as Morgenstern says, like if we do nothing, he's going to explode.
I know. I was like, I kind of want to see what that looks like, but also, no, do something. That's wrong.
If there was a way, a non-lethal way of seeing what that looked like. And Kerry is in the strange position that if Morgenstern is out of the room or out of the building, Kerry's in charge of the ER.
Yeah.
But he's her boss. And if there's one person on Earth who understands the chain of command, it's Kerry Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a bit like, do I take charge? And it's seconds this is done in. And Morgenstern, in fairness, he goes, we need to do something. And even though indecision is written all over his face, he just gets a syringe.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, it reminded me of that scene of Pulp Fiction where they put the adrenaline into And he goes, and there's just this, it's sort of comical, but I suppose it's as real as any medical procedures. They basically let the gas out.
Mm-hmm.
And the man, you know, he stabilizes and everything seems fine. I remember thinking, what must that have smelled like?
Those digestive juices.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd say not that would good. Have knocked everyone in the room for six.
Yeah.
But he saves the man's life.
He does. So he had a win from Morgenstern.
Yeah.
And so, I think because the way they set the scene up as well is at the beginning he's trying to do one procedure and he can't get it, so Kerry's like, I'll do it.
They're trying to shove the tube up his nose
and there's a sense of, oh, I'll do it because actually you probably don't know really what you're doing anymore. But it turns out he's right and she does say, you know, you were right, sorry, kind of, which I thought was interesting because this is where I felt like they were going to go down one path where he was going to go, I can't do this anymore. This isn't for me. I've changed. Here you go, Kerry. Here's the keys and walk off into the sunset, you know. And he turned back around and went, here I go. Look, I can do it just as well or whatever, you know. It just takes a bit of time to get back in. I just thought that was an interesting twist.
They did something interesting with the camera, I think. So, you know, when he jabs the chap's stomach, which, you know, it does look bloated.
Mm.
I think they lowered the camera very slightly. Yeah, just to make it look like his stomach had slightly reduced.
Yeah, it was good. Like, whether it was forced perspective or whatever, it was very well done.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, I don't normally notice those sort of things. It's usually Sean that notices. So I was
letting you have this one, you know.
Oh, thanks, babe. Cheers.
Team player.
And they kind of finish with this last. It's short. This little exchange just at the ambulance bay.
It's nice because
sometimes you see there, and there will be stories again where people who are maybe in an altered state and are in the ER and really shouldn't be working there, and it sometimes takes a little bit of time for them to accept that, and it kind of looks like it's going to go that way. And he stands there and he says, it's actually for the nicest reason ever. He's like, you know, you care about admin, Kerry. You really actually care about the administration and managerial side. He says, my problem is I care about everything.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit too much, almost. And it's not like an accepting a defeat or anything like that. He's just like, yeah. And it's written all over everyone's face, like, this could be a problem, but right now it's a positive. He cares and he wants everything to go well. But I think definitely I saw the Kerry's road to chief of emergency medicine. I think the paving slabs are being a bit solidified here.
Absolutely. Yeah. She knows. And maybe it should, because she does, she, you know, he says to her, you're so much better at all that. I never, I couldn't ever kind of get my head into it. And I think that's, you know, why not? Maybe he does need to stand aside and go, actually, next generation. Yeah.
I did like that he sort of acknowledged, she said, I hope you don't feel like I was questioning. He said, no, you've been conscientious, and that's a sign of a good manager, a good leader. I was like, she covers her bases like nobody's business.
Whatever else about Kerry, and we spoke about Kerry last week and how herself and Doug were speaking, they seem to be civil, at least this week, which is,
I see.
Considering how last week ended, it was, I think they, you know, the fact that they weren't chucking chairs at each other this week was a step forward. But and again, that's why whatever we can say about Kerry, and we will probably at great length in some episodes to come, at this point in her career, the ambition is there. Mm-hmm. The genuine interest in what she's doing is there. Yeah. Some people can't, Mark couldn't give a toss about the admin side of being, you know, attending.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kerry does care.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think she sees that it's definitely a big part of the puzzle to make things go right for her. It's part of the everyday, because if you make this run, then we can have all this running. Whereas Mark's like, I'm going to come in, I'm going to see patients, I don't care about all that above stuff. And that's not anything against Mark, because people are different, and it takes all kinds to make a team work, and Mark is great and has strengths where places Kerry doesn't, so it balances out. But it's interesting. She's an interesting character, and again, another interesting female character, because she's not just, you know, she is ambitious, she does care, she does work hard, and she does let people know that she works hard. She's not apologising or hiding away or trying to make herself smaller, which for a woman, and especially in this era, is an amazing thing to see, taking up space and going, I know my stuff and I'm going to show my stuff, you know. So where shall we head next?
I was thinking, again, it's just like, you know, all right, Sean, you're just bursting through the small ones, because, again, he has a tiny role in this episode, Mark. I mean, he's in it, but he doesn't really do much.
He doesn't, yeah. You're right, it's true, it's true.
Yeah.
He's more there as sort of a gateway to Corday and Doug's stories. So just to kind of cover him for a second, that he, you know, he's there to like, hello, that's Morgan Stern, and he's wonderful. And then, so he's... Maybe Doug first. He and Doug are chatting at the start of the episode, and Doug kind of alludes to this conversation they need to have. This conversation they need to have. And Mark's like, yeah, grand, whatever, that's fine. And he kind of suggests that they go out for drinks or for dinner that night. And Doug goes, actually, I've got plans with Carol. I should ask Carol. I think he says, you know, we might have plans. Or maybe I've got that backwards. Maybe he doesn't say that first, because
So I think he's saying tonight, and Mark says yes. And it's later he kind of says to Carol, I'm going out with Mark. And she goes, oh, we have this such and such planned. And he's like, oh, I'll cancel. And she's like, no, you know, that's fine. You go ahead. You need to have that conversation. So yeah, that kind of comes a bit later. The thing I wanted to point out, and I don't know if this happened to you guys, but at the beginning, you know, when they're kind of standing in that really busy place, I was like, I thought they were in the ER, and then, you know, they were in like the waiting room and there was just people everywhere, and then it turns out actually it's the cafeteria. That was funny, because we rarely get to see them really chill and stop and have any kind of breakfast or you know, so it's quite nice to see them perch and stop and they see Benton, and it's cute, because to me it was like, oh, look, the OG men are all kind of sitting around the
that's nice
little table, which I really liked. So Mark is kind of has no idea what Doug wants to talk to him about, but apparently Doug's gonna speak to him later. And in between that, as you say, with Corday, as we know, has been working on this kind of fake blood or HemoAid, as they call it. And she's actually decided to bring it down into the ER. And Mark has kindly agreed to kind of sponsor that and be her kind of, what's the word?
Faculty supervisor.
That's it, exactly that, which she'll need to do this. So, so those are the big Mark things, aren't they? We've got this kind of, what's it, push and pull between Doug wanting to speak to Mark, but also not wanting to speak to Mark and kind of cancelling on him, even though he shouldn't. And we've got the Corday, he's kind of supporting Corday, who is kind of going against Romano, which, you know, we'll get into. But yeah, Mark's just kind of feels a bit like a side player, doesn't he, in this episode, which is no bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's kind of, he's just there this week, which is like, he's had enough for the last few weeks, you know, he's kind of like, you know, Mark, give somebody else a chance. I really have nothing else to say about Mark. He's there this week.
I think the problem. I think the problem with trying to speak about Mark this week is there isn't anything we can really talk about. He's not. The things we need to talk about with him are with people. So if we do Doug and talk about what Mark is with Doug, and if we do Corday, we talk about that's that's what I don't think he's got his own personal. This is what's happening in Markland.
He's had a lot of attention lately, so he's. Let's, you know, he can take a back seat for a bit.
Yes, exactly. You know,
whole episode about him and his family.
That is true. So then it's kind of toss of a coin. Do we cover Corday first? Because Corday covers the Benton storyline as well. Or do we cover Doug first, which of course brings in the Genie storyline? They're pretty much both even Stevens.
which one's the most traumatic? The Genie one. So let's go through Doug here.
Okay. So Doug, as it transpires, Doug is trying to speak to Mark about he wants to not renew his PEDS fellowship. So we finished last week with that was the argument between himself and Kerry is that he wants a PEDS, at least resident, to sign off on any PEDS pediatric case in the ER.
Yeah.
And this was they were butting heads. Mark stepped in because Kerry said she is perfectly qualified to deal with children, which she is. She made a mistake, but she is perfectly qualified to do it. Anyone can make a mistake, to which Mark was able to more or less get Doug to see, I get that you're angry. She's not wrong.
Yeah, because he does not agree either. You know, they're both like, actually, you know, we don't. But Doug's not listening. I think it must be really frustrating for them. Because I imagine what he's saying to them is, you know, you're not qualified enough, or you're not doing a good enough job. And that's not true. And also, I have to say, though, it's just bringing up Weaver. She doesn't always go about things the right way. Like, she doesn't learn with Doug. He doesn't listen to her, and she loves lecturing him. So at the beginning of this episode, she's lecturing him the fact that he hasn't got his proposal in, he hasn't done what he needs to do, and he just basically turns around and says, well, maybe I don't want to be the fellow anymore, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, because obviously, much as we love Doug, Doug can be every bit as much of a child as the people he treats.
I think that it's really tough with Doug sometimes as well, because he does act in ways that frustrate me. You know, he'll do things like there's something later on with Scotty that he does that Green, you know, Mark's not happy about, and Anspar's not that particularly that happy about, but he doesn't listen to anybody. He just goes, well, I want to do it, therefore I'm doing it, rather than going, hang on a minute, let me work with people. And it's sometimes hard to root for him when he's like that.
That's the point of it attending, is that they are it is a leadership role in a lot of ways, and you've got to be able, as you say, be able to manage people, delegate, have good working relationships with as many people around you as possible.
Yeah,
you don't see that in Doug. As you've said he's still quite immature.
I feel like with him trying to go for an attending position is more about then not having to report to other people, having that power himself, not having those 100%. Checks and balances, rather than it being up for other reasons. That's where you worry, don't you? Because he just wants to kind of carve out his own little PEDS ER area else interferes with, and it's just not right.
He's an excellent, excellent caregiver. Like, there's no, in my opinion, and obviously there's examples, but overall, in my opinion, I wouldn't be worried about him in terms of patient care. I would be worried about, like you said, acting impulsively. I think he will always, I don't think there's ever a question of his ethics, and it's always to do the right thing, but his strive to do the right thing can make him very blinded to, maybe nuance is the wrong word, but like, there are things that might sound good if you're the knight in shining armor. It doesn't necessarily make them right.
And I think he can sometimes his lack of really understanding or lack of care of the fact that there are certain rules in place, you know, that's where him and Weaver butt heads, because he thinks, oh, Weaver's just being like, you know, oh, I'm telling you what to do. But actually Weaver's going, if you don't do it this way, we could lose funding, or we could lose this or lose that. And he just doesn't take a moment to appreciate any of those finer details, which I think ends up being a bit of a downfall for him.
I think you're right. And there's a certain amount of, maybe Weaver doesn't know how to speak to him in the most productive way. And she's got this idea in her head of, you know, Doug the cowboy, he's, you know, he doesn't respect authority, doesn't respect my authority, therefore I'm going to be bullish with him. When actually maybe they need to find that middle ground and see each other as valuable, but they're not going to, because they're both stuck. And also it would make good drama. It wouldn't make good TV.
True, yeah.
You're great. No, you're great.
No, I love you more.
And so, it's funny because Doug at the beginning of the episode is like, yes, I want to speak to Mark. Mark, I'm going to speak to you. We're going to have this dinner. And then later he's like, oh, Mark, I can't. I've got to be with Carol. So at some point he kind of chickens out of actually having that conversation. I'm not entirely sure why he does that, but he does do that. He's very, I want to get, you know, in with, I want to hang out with Carol.
It's a good question as to why. I suppose it happens a fair bit, but but none of that sentence was English. I'm agreeing with you, basically. So one of the things that comes up for him that is this week's butting heads with Mark is, so we kind of have to almost hit pause on Doug for a second and go to Jeannie and Scotty.
Because
we start with them, and first of all, I think there's a hot dog involved and everyone's very happy, and we find out that they're going rock climbing. It's very cool, and I love this. I love this friendship.
Me too. It's really sweet, and it feels very based on equals, in the sense that at no point does Jeannie ever talk down to him or think that he's, you know, silly because he's little or he won't be able to. She really treats him like an adult, and I think that's why there's that respect between them. And we also learn that he's going to Yosemite in the summer, so that's why she's kind of surprised him with this like, let's go rock climbing, because it'll be something he might be doing in Yosemite, I guess. So
I want to go with them. Can I go with them?
Yes,
thanks.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
I don't know how I'd feel about going without Spa, but carry on.
I think it'd be quite interesting, but Scott and Jeannie would be fun.
Oh god, they would be so fun. I'd feel a bit left out though, because they'd be getting on and I'd be like, what about me?
I don't want to hang out with Dad.
Don't leave me with him, you know, when it's like, we're all getting in this car, you two sit here, you two sit, I don't want to be the front with Anspa.
Those are so mean.
Let's listen to some John Philip Sousa on the way there.
That time in the war when
me and General Patton were good friends.
Anyway,
it looks like, so not to put a big massive downer on us, Jeannie climbs up and she shows Scotty nothing to worry about, and Scotty starts to climb up, and it looks for a moment like he has a bout of anxiety that perhaps it's the heights that is getting to him, and he's like, no, I have to come down. And she's like, there is a moment of Jeannie being the most amazing person in the world, she does a moment of, no, I'm going to see if I can push it. And then she sees straight away, no, he means this. So down he comes.
And she apologizes. And I loved that. I love that she went, I shouldn't have pushed you, because there are so many moments where people do things like that and then don't accept that, you know, you resisting that or not having the best time with that is an important thing that they should acknowledge. Go, actually, you know what, it was my bad. I don't want you feeling bad because you couldn't climb or whatever. Anyway, just a very small point, but.
But yeah, no, it's such a good point. And especially, again, what I love in Jeannie and Scott's relationship is that she is very much an adult. He is very much a child. There is never a question of that. And yet, in a certain way, there is an equality.
Mm.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't feel a lot of the time like a carer / dependent.
Yes, exactly that. And it doesn't feel like, oh, she's having to do this. It feels like she's having just as much fun with him and cares for him the same way he kind of does for her. And I think that's what's really, really lovely, because they seem to respect what each other brings to the relationship. They, you know, as you say, they're not both adults, but it doesn't make a difference, because I think she appreciates the young of him and he appreciates her being this adult who can get him to do cool things like rock climb. But anyway, as you say, so
he comes back down and he looks really kind of like, it looks like it was quite almost a panic attack. Like he's very, he's breathing heavy, and And the next we see is that she's actually brought him to the ER.
Mm-hmm.
And initially you're like, well, maybe look, this is, we know he's not long after chemo. Like, God, of course we will play on the side of caution here.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so Doug being our pediatrician, the two stories merge together. And so they're doing a test on him, and to go to Doug's side of the storyline again, Doug basically hooks him up to a machine where he can control his own pain medication.
Yes, it's the PCA that he was presenting PCA. About. That's what... He was presenting about previously. It's all about giving patients their own control over their pain medication. So when they feel pain, they can press a button. We also learn it locks out, so there's no point. You can't overdose.
Mm.
This is where he butts heads with Mark, because Anspar's worried and didn't realise that they had a PCA for children and Mark didn't. And this is where you've got to kind of keep Mark involved, and you've got to tell people, actually, this is what I'm doing, so that things are thought about. And Mark can back you and go, actually, yes, because we've done this test, or we know this, or, you know, it's just that's the role of Mark. You know, he is his boss and he just needs to learn to accept that at some point.
He needs to, and to try and frame it another way, like, because he's like, oh, do I have to ask your permission? First of all, I would argue, yes. But that aside, it means he has your back. Like, least the department is aware of what's happening, because God forbid, you know, something happens. And, you know, let's say this was the day the lockout button didn't work.
Exactly.
You know, or something like that. And the next thing, hang on, let me get this straight. You brought down a machine that was faulty, told no one, hooked up a patient, and they ended up accidentally, or potentially not accidentally, depending on the situation, overdosing.
Yeah. And a child at that, you know.
I was like, never mind, fired. Like, you're getting arrested for this. Yeah. He comes outside, and obviously Anspar has gone, what? And says it to Mark, and Mark says, Mark is being very nice about it. He's like, Doug, just tell me. That's all. Just tell me so that I'm aware that we're doing this. Because otherwise, let's say, again, earlier on in the day, for whatever reason, someone asks Mark, oh, are you using PCA machines in the ER? And he will emphatically say no.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And he would pass a polygraph.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And say he was an insurance clerk or something. Mm. Oh, we're doing your insurance. Oh, you're not. Okay, great. I'll mark that you're not using it. Oh, hang on. Somebody's now passed away from it. Actually, we can't cover you because you told us you weren't using it. You know, all those. I think that's what it is that Doug doesn't seem to understand. He doesn't seem to get that everybody's on his side. He just sees what he sees what he wants to do. Anybody who says no or questions it or says, actually, we need to put some stuff in place, not a no, but we need to put stuff in place. He just takes as opposition and he's right. They're wrong. Therefore, he's going to give Scotty this, you know, this thing. And it could be dangerous. We don't know enough about it. Things aren't in place, you know. And it's weird to for something to be so experimental and you're just kind of bringing it in and not really. It feels like, because it's quite new and an experimental, like a parent should be signing off on it rather than, you know, how they have to get authorization. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. It just seems very weird that all of a sudden it's like, no, I'm telling you, this is what we're doing. So Doug kind of. He does that, which isn't great. And then, I mean, in the end, Carol says to them both, you know, I'm not hanging out with you two. You guys have got to go and hang out yourselves. Mm. And we don't see that conversation or see that moment. But it's the beginning of this kind of what we've seen before from Doug. And I feel a bit like Doug always has to have a project to something that he needs to bang a drum about. So he was really quiet at work when he was banging his I want to marry Carol drum, mm-hmm. or I want to prove to Carol I'm committed drum. And now that they are in a better place, in a good place, he's like, right, I need a new bang drum subject.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's, yeah. No, so unfortunately, this is almost a weird way of doing this. So hitting pause on Doug, well, not really. So Doug basically has to talk to Jeannie about, we have to do it. We have to do a biopsy. Yeah. Of course we do. Like, and it's, I mean, you hear the word biopsy, you know where this is going. But in fact, it is a perfectly normal procedure that just has to be done. But I think we all know.
Yeah.
And it's been a week. I mean, I think more time is said to have gone by in the show.
Yeah.
But it's very, very, very soon.
But for us, it's like, oh, it's, and she's obviously really scared. So her reaction is very, you're not doing a biopsy, you don't need to do that, it's fine. And he says, no, these are the reasons. Yeah. And fair play to her, you know, she sits with him and he's having that really horrible procedure and she's basically holding on. It's hideous to watch. And she's holding on to him and she's talking about rock climbing and about Yosemite and all that stuff to kind of get him through. And then Carol says to Jeannie as well, oh, we're going to start a drive. This is before they even know. And she says, oh, we're going to start a blood marrow kind of donation drive to just find out if there's any matches or anything like that. And which is a lovely thing to do. But
yes, it is. Yeah.
But obviously in the state that, you know, Jeannie's in, she kind of says, actually, you know, give him a chance. You know, you're just jumping on it before anything's happened. And I completely get why she says that and where that's coming from. But it also shows us that how upset she is and how involved she's definitely become kind of with Scotty. And it's so interesting when Doug comes to say to her, look, it's back.
Yeah.
I'm going to go tell Scotty and Anspo now. Do you want to come? And she says no, because for me, it was like, oh gosh, she's really affected, because normally Jeannie would be able to put all that aside and she would be there and holding his hand, but she can't face it. And I just thought it has worn her down to that.
Yeah.
That point, and that was really, you know, for her to act so out of character. And it's, we get that love. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got to the point where it's good that she is now not Scotty's caregiver, like primary carer, because she's too emotionally involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, there's a moment with Anspar where he says to her, and I thought, wow, what a 180 that none of us would have ever expected. Have you told him about your own status, about your own medical issues that are happening? And Scott senses something in you. That's why I think you guys kind of get on, and maybe you should tell him. And I just thought, wow, you know, he's gone from what Anspar was to actually go tell my son who's young. And, you know, so you get parents who wouldn't want kids knowing about AIDS because they're in their head, or HIV, whatever. Mm. Anyway.
They want to protect the children from the reality of life.
The gay plague, you know, there was still a lot of homophobia around it, and if we teach them about AIDS or HIV, we'll have to teach them about gay people, and if we teach them about gay people, they'll become gay, you know. Well, that's stupid,
the nonsense of
it, of
the time. No, it was obviously exactly. It was getting better long way ago, but getting better at that point. But yes, so the ignorance of the time and a relatively short journey helped along an awful lot, of course, by Jeannie and Scott's relationship. Anspa has, I suppose, come around, or I think maybe, would it be fair to say that less so come around than had to pull his head out of his ass and actually look at the world?
Yeah.
And actually, now I'm saying it, you know, Anspa was never, he was never against her and the HIV. Yeah. I think he had wanted to be informed or wanted to know.
Yeah.
So I think I've been painting him a bit unfair. But, you know, there were still, as we say, you know, a lot of us fear and a lot of maybe she shouldn't be working or whatever. But, yeah, he really is seeing her as a human. And you can see how she's also helped him and Scotty be friends, because there's that moment where she comes in with him to the hospital and Scott and Anspar's there and he's like, oh, we're going to go to Yosemite. And he's just talking to Scotty in a way we hadn't seen before. And he's actually the one sitting with him and handling kind of the news a lot better than Jeannie's handling at this point, which, you know, wasn't always the case. So I just think she's also really helped kind of open that relationship up, which is really sweet.
It's the Jeannie Boulay magic.
I'm telling you.
And I'm not even joking about that. She does spread magic and joy and love wherever she goes.
She is the angel touching everyone.
Don't pin that on her.
Hey, I'm just saying, it's going to make us all look at it a different way. She was touched by an angel. You know what?
She's an angel. That is a good way to put it. I don't think she's the one who's Mr. Bad Touch.
People,
but
no.
Yeah.
And then we have this scene at the end where she's crying. You know, she's with Scotty and she's kind of crying, and he wakes up and she kind of can't look at him straight away. She has to try, and she's trying to gather herself, isn't she? And and he's the strong one, isn't he, for her more than. And it was just a really lovely moment, because this is what is great about relationships, is that's what happens. Somebody gets stronger, somebody needs help, somebody gets, the other person gets stronger. And that's what we've seen. We've seen Jeannie be so strong for him all these months or whatever. And now he's turned around and gone, hey, you know, it's, you know, we're going, like, to do something about it.
When you think of how full of fear he was initially, understandably so, to how resigned and... Donald Anspaugh says, you know, he's gonna fight this, it's, they don't say the words, Jeannie has given him the fight to live.
That's a really good point.
He's kind of gone, actually, maybe this isn't insurmountable, because I had Jeannie last time and that made it a lot better than it was before. And he asked her to go to Yosemite with them, which is also really sweet, you know. It's like she's just become kind of part of the family. And it's just a really, it's a really hard storyline, and tough and beautiful in other ways, you know.
Because it happens to Jeannie, because, as you say, she's this lightning rod for stress and trauma and drama.
She's the beauty in his pain, which is a
that is great,
which is a lyric from a song that I've just stolen, but called Beautiful by Duncan Lawrence. I have to obviously put that out there so he knows that I'm not stealing. That's what she is, I feel. So yeah, that's kind of the mark, that's kind of, sorry, Doug
and Jeannie.
I can't, no names have all gone from my head.
This is definitely an ensemble episode, like everyone gets something except Mark. Everyone pretty much gets something to do, because even, and maybe just before we speak about Corday, Carter and Benton, just really quickly, I suppose Carol, because her storyline somewhat tiny crosses over with Doug.
It is, but very important one, though, isn't it?
Very, very important. Oh my God, actually. So kind of like, whoa, did not see that coming in this episode.
Yeah, but also I was a bit like, I don't know, she kept making such a point. So she's at the clinic, she's working in the clinic, clinic's all still going. A girl comes in for her birth control. She makes a big point about the fact that she's come in with her dad, which is why I was like, hang on a minute.
You're really saying,
you're really going, that is your dad who brought you in. Let's point at him a neon sign. Anyway, you know, she gives her the injection and kind of talks her through contraception and all that stuff, and gives her some condoms, all that kind of stuff, you know. Talks to her properly like an adult. I think, again, really good example and good modeling of talking to teenagers about sex rather than just shutting it down, you know, and saying it's dirty and you shouldn't be doing it. Actually, it's going to happen, let's do things safely. And it's human nature, maybe it isn't dirty and all that stuff.
She's matter of fact said, what about STDs, you might not be able to get pregnant, but what about your boyfriend? And as you say, talks to her as an equal again, which gets the message through.
She says something, just so she said, sometimes my boyfriend forgets. So just to put a pin in that for a moment, so Carol responds with, come on now, it's your responsibility too. And she gives her condoms and talks her through everything and basically sends her on her merry way, and that could have been the end of that. You know, and the next thing, Carol is being called out to reception and the girl is back again. This time she's there with the mother, and it looks, initially it looks like the mother is about to go through Carol for a shortcut, and and that's not what happens. But I love the way they frame this, that the mother is there and you just got, these are the condoms you gave my daughter. So it's just like, oh, here we go. And she goes, I just want to know what's happening. And that's the first of the diffusion. And it's, oh, thank God, it's not militant mother coming in to go, you know,
my daughters can't be having sex, why are you making my daughter have sex?
Why that's exactly what it seemed like. You are making, you know, you are, you know, putting these thoughts in her head. Carol just calmly, everyone's calm, everyone's brilliant this week for calmly dealing with complainants, and she goes, legally, it's against the law for me to discuss this with you. And the mother, she at that point, she just like, she just goes, I just want to know what's going on. And Carol goes, okay, perhaps I can speak with her in private, and then maybe we can answer some questions later. And that's more or less grand. So in she comes, and this is when the bombshell is dropped.
yes,
that man who brought her in earlier was not her father. It was her boyfriend. Okay, that's because now there is the question of age. She is under 18. So in fairness, it doesn't matter if he's 18. She's under 18. There is a crime being committed.
Still statutory rape.
Exactly. You cannot consent. That's the whole thing of statutory rape. It's like you cannot legally consent. So even if you say yes, legally, it's still... Anyway, so this is where... So then we get... It's like, right, bingo, okay? Who had... My wife is unstable. I couldn't possibly tell her. Who is... He's my teacher, so we must keep... I will marry you when you turn 18. And this is where it comes back to, sometimes my boyfriend forgets... Oh, really? This man who is in a position of authority over you and apparently is so responsible that he is feeding you all of this bullcrap about how
he's grooming you, basically.
Malarkey, absolutely grooming you. And yet he can't even be bothered to remember to use protection, exactly, knowing he is sleeping with at least one other person.
Yes, exactly. You know?
So you're just like, okie dokie. Right, can we get CPS down here?
And it's another power thing, you know, it's another power thing. I'm not going to use this because I don't want to use it, and she's just going to have to deal with it. And when you know, and she's in this unequal relationship, she can't always be like, actually, I insist, because that's not how it's set up. And and I think they're trying to make it a crime, or it's become a crime now, that if somebody removes it before, you know, without your knowledge, removes the condom or at any point, that you can now, I think, go after them for that. Because there have been...
Wrong. I think that's now called stealthing. I'm not sure. I presume that came from slang. I'm not sure if that's the legal term.
Yeah.
Obviously, to remove it a stealthy way. And it is. It is absolutely, because it is non-consensual.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've not consented to you trying to give me, you know, whatever...
A baby,
well, or you know, STDs, any of that stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, he's the teacher, which is just like, oh, hideous. And Carol calls the police, which she needed to do, but she's also worried because she's like, I know it was rape and all that, but I don't want other kids to hear that I've done that and then not want to come in. Okay. I just don't feel like there's enough kids sleeping with teachers that would hear about that and then not come in. But I get it, you know, it shows how difficult that line
for them. Yeah,
you know, there's a difficult to tread that line, and it just shows a little bit about the role that this clinic has in the lives of the Chicago teens.
Yeah, I mean, that teacher could be doing that with other people who could have done it historically.
It sounds like he probably has.
I feel it sounds like
a well-worn line.
Yes.
About, oh, you know, my wife's unstable, once you're 18 we'll get married.
Mm-hmm.
It just maybe I'm watching too many Criminal Minds, but yeah, that needs to get shut down right now.
It feels very smooth, too clean, and the fact that, you know, he was taking it to the clinic, and it's all very... Yeah.
He knows where the clinic is.
Yeah, this is what he does. So yeah, that's Carol's kind of little slice this week. Although she does come back, she goes out with, you know, we have this lovely scene at the end with Corday, which we'll get to, but...
Actually, I love that scene as well. But it's
brilliant.
Okay,
to Benton Corday?
Benton Corday, yeah.
I just love Benton this week. He's being Mr. Dad here. So he is so putting Reese in daycare. He's got a plan. He knows how to deal with stuff. He's got this plan. He's going to do everything at a certain time. You know, really schedule everything to the last second. You know, Reese is in daycare at the hospital. He's feeding him and spending a bit of time with him. Obviously, Reese, you know, puts porridge on his head.
I love that fun stuff. I looked, did you have a look at the IMDb for this? There's one goof apparently in the episode. No, I must say I didn't notice it myself on watching it, but the first thing of the goofs is that there's one problem with that scene, is that you can quite clearly see a Caucasian adult hand, the one that tips the bowl over onto Benton's head, and I thought, oh wow, Reese, you look different somehow.
Yes, what's going on there? So we have that really sweet moment. He's showing him kind of juggle, you know, being a parent. So obviously he now has to go and have a shower. So off he goes to have a shower. I love that when he's showering, he's still going through all the anatomy. It just shows he's just so
It's just never switches off.
Ever, you know, this. He's probably got it in there. I'm going to shower. And if I'm going to shower, I'm going to have to use the time wisely. I can't have 2 seconds off where I'm just showering. I need to run through every single thing. And Corday comes because she's becoming more and more like a little sexual pervert. But
I love the fact that he even puts it like, Elizabeth, I know you've wanted to see, and I believe he's being deadpan as he says this as well. Yeah. Like, I know you've wanted to see me naked, but this isn't the way. It's like, okay, that's okay. Yeah, fair. Yeah, great.
I don't do the whole thing. If that was a man doing that to a woman, but at the same time, if a man did that to a woman, that would be a massive problem.
And it would
be rightly be a problem.
I wasn't comfortable with it myself watching this. I know they were playing it for laughs, and I get that. Absolutely. But
like,
I was a bit uncomfortable about it all. And there's just something as well about kind of the stereotypes of kind of black sexual virility, and
it does play, and I think as well the fact that Eric LaSalle is quite a physically fit man in this scene, you know, not that he isn't now, but I'm just saying, like, so there are visual identifiers to, oh, isn't he so pretty? Like, for me, I felt, I mean, this conversation could have happened in any room in the ER, but they chose to have him in the shower. And they chose it to be Corday handing him a towel. Like, is this ER giving into thirst traps? Because that's what this scene is.
It really is. I think it's a way of showing kind of how, I guess, she's so unguarded, isn't she? She's so not, like, if he'd stepped out naked, I don't think she would miss a beat, because she's so cool about all that stuff. And she's kind of come along to really rock him out of the little box he's in, hasn't he? So I think what they're trying to do is show that, you know. So he comes out, and basically she's trying to talk to him because they've got this literary review, or lit review I should say, and she's trying to plan time with him, and he's very, and she's doing her usual, you know, we could go for dinner after, or we can order a foodie, you know, being very flirty. And he's just very matter of fact. I've got to be out by 7:02 because I've got this and then this, you know. And then later, you know, we see Benton. So he is he's basically in surgery with Romano. And Romano's being such I'm working with Lizzie. Did that upset you? Did that annoy you that I chose her over you? And I mean, Benton looks like he could give less of a shit. You know, he's just like...
Yeah. Like, he's just like, and even Romano says, like, oh, you're being a really good liar. I really don't think he's lying. No. Romano. Benton 2 seasons ago, sure, he would have slashed her tires.
Yeah.
But, you know, this Benton, he really has other things. He still very much cares, like, as you say, in the shower, going through anatomy. But... yeah, no, he has other things on his mind.
I wonder as well how much of that is that he doesn't really respect Romano. I don't know if he does or not, but, you know, it feels very much like maybe this doctor doesn't impress him, so he doesn't care so much if to jump through all the hoops of his. I don't know.
He's deflected a lot of Romano's early bullshit.
Yeah.
Basically, so when Romano has made comments about his race, Ben's just been like, what? Okay.
Yeah, it's like, whatever.
He's not angry, which is what Romano wanted, so he could turn around and say, oh, you are one of those militant minorities, to use a phrase from a previous episode. But
yeah,
I know. But Romano, he's my pet hate project or something.
All roads lead to
all roads lead to Romano, to use a phrase from back in the day. But he is showing full Romano in that. He goes around stirring so much today.
Yes.
He may as well just, like, flown in on a giant wooden spoon.
Oh, he's just...
For his big cauldron of bullshit.
Crap.
I like that.
Sorry for the swearing today, guys.
So Benton gets called out, basically, of the surgery because, you know, Reese isn't very well.
Yeah.
The next time we see him, he's kind of in the hallway struggling. So Reese has got a temperature. He's trying to figure out how to get him over to Carla. And that's when Corday happens upon him, and he's saying to her, look, I've got to take him. I've got to get back. I've got this surgery and my car's broken down. So she says, well, I could take him, which Benton is like, no, because how would I explain you turning up with my son to Carla, you know? And this wasn't in those days where you could text Carla and be like, just so you know, Elizabeth, she's a colleague, whatever. You wouldn't be able to do any of that. So he says, I'll come with you. So he drives, and Lizzie being Lizzie and Corday that we love, you know, he's getting petrol because he's like, he's like my dad. My dad is like this. If it's half a tank, it's practically empty. That is my dad. So he's filling up for petrol, and he kind of gets in the car, and Corday just says to him, is it race? Is that, you know, we get on, there's an obstacle in the way. Is it race?
And I love many things about Corday, but she certainly doesn't pull the question. Like, she's like, is this it? Is it race? Like, you know, because she handles everything so well, with the exception of the shower scene. And I agree with you, but I do think that was poor writing, I have to say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But because she handles everything, like, there is a moment of, girl, who's just that not into you? But the way she handles herself and conducts herself, like, you know, oh, is it this? Is this what it is? And she was there's no filter near her.
She picks for that. She will, she's the one to speak about the elephant in the room. The first thing she will do, you know, and it does. And it won't faze her. It's not hard for her to do it. She just asks him. And, you know, Benton, he completely ready to talk to her. Is he? No, he reverses the car instead of going forward and hits a woman, which is his kind of reaction to being asked that question.
Oh my god.
It's fine, everything's fine. Boom. Yeah. So they end up obviously having to go back to the hospital, because, you know, this woman's been run over, and Reese also needs to be checked out, as well as Benton. And Benton goes into, well, he finds out that the lady actually works in a law firm, which sets alarm bells. He's like, oh my god, she's basically going to come after my everything. So he gets Mr. Wright, let's order every single test known to man, and also trying to harangue Anna, who's looking after Reese, and they have to basically calm him down, and Mark has to take him because he's got a cut on his head. But he spends the rest of the episode like that, even though, you know, we find out Reese is fine. He keeps haranguing Carter, who's sad, poor Carter's drawn the short straw of having to look after this lady and do all the tests, and he keeps saying, you haven't done this test, you need to do that test, and, you know, we need to make completely sure. And it's brilliant because they have that moment where he kind of says, Carter, you've missed something, and Carter just coolly turns the page, just flips the page, you've missed something, and it turns out the woman was a little bit tipsy.
And there's that moment where, like, just Benton's face, and also I have to, like, obviously it's an extended sort of, but I love the implication that is like, we're gonna look after her. She was what? Die, bitch.
This is on you. You can't do anything to
her. Her face is like, okay. Yeah.
Well, he's like, I can sue you for damage to my car and my child and my forehead. You know, so we've had that happen, and he's free, but then he sees Corday and Carla, because Carla's come to pick up Reese and obviously check in on everybody after the accident, and he's just
like, Carla couldn't seem to give less of a poo about the fact that Corday is standing. Like, Corday has basically saved Peter's ass in every situation of the day.
Exactly.
And she's like, oh, Elizabeth just found me, and he's like, oh, and Carla's just like, I got my
don't look at
you,
her
you do you go away. Like,
She's like, I don't pay attention to anything you're doing, but he's very much like, he makes it more of an issue. It's like with Jackie, you know, Jackie said, oh, hi, how are you? This woman is a colleague. This is a work event. We are not friends. We don't even know each other, you know.
Who Jackie's is she? Like, stop following me around.
Yeah, you're basically doing that. And Carla's just like, whatever, you know, takes Reese away. And that's when he kind of has a go at her, doesn't he? Corday kind of says, you know, I should have got my car fixed. I should have done this. I should have done that. And basically insinuating he should never have got in the car with her. And this is all his own stress of being found out to have feelings for a white woman, possibly, you know, and other people in the community or people he knows looking at him and judging him for that. And he just takes it all out on Corday, who basically just turns around and says, you know what? No, you know, I'm not having that. F off, basically. And just... decides to have a girls' night with her friend, her friends instead, which is a really delightful scene because it's her, Anna, and Carol, And they're just having cocktails and letting loose and talking about men and sex and just really having fun.
And I'm very upset because we were about to get some salacious details from Carol about her sex life with Doug, and the bloody doorbell goes and, you know, kind of, and Cordelia's like, oh, it's fine. It's going to be pizza. I'll be right back now. And it's one of the few times in my life I've been disappointed to see Peter Benton. I must say, I
sort of found that cold. Sort of, I loved that they were out together and loved they're hanging out and having cosmos and stuff like that. But at the same time, oh, tell us about your sex life. Just seemed a little bit
contrived, like girl. Yeah, wouldn't.
A little bit. And then you know, let's have this girly chat, and they're all for it, and that's fair enough. But it felt sort of laid a bit thick.
Yes.
Maybe. I just been a horrendous misogynist again?
As opposed to when. But sorry. I jest. But I do get exactly where you're coming from with that. Now, I enjoyed the scene, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, definitely.
But it was a bit like, I don't think I'm speaking to my own thoughts in my head here as I say this, but I don't think the fact that they go from medical professionals who are extremely competent in what they do to stereotypical ladies' night with cosmos talking about sex life, I don't think it robs them of agency, but I do get that. I say this is just now, I picked that English language hard out of really my head hard. There because I don't want to suggest that anyone sitting around having cosmos talking about a sex life doesn't have agency. That's not what I mean. But I do get the whiplash of we've gone from professional setting to personal setting with absolutely nothing in between. I feel like maybe if they'd even, let's say we had an extra 5 minutes of the episode, had them arriving at the apartment, even something like that, you know, before it goes straight to, although... Who am I to comment on the writing, he says, having commented on 85 episodes?
For me, I completely get what you're saying. What I took from the episode was very much, so women do share and women do get together and barriers can fall very easily. And especially, I imagine, you know, in the kind of workplace that they have. I also think that Corday is very good at getting people to talk about things they might not normally talk about, and she is, as we've seen, very, you know, she's very sexually, her appetite for sex is high, and so it is on her mind, and that's what I took from it. I thought this is what she does when she gets with people. She gets them to talk. We've seen her get Peter to talk about things he's never been ready to talk about, and I think it's just a moment where these women get to actually dish and just be women, because they don't get to do that at work and we don't really get to see their other lives, but it seems very much like the job takes over, and it didn't feel unrealistic to me. I guess I've been in situations where you're with people you don't particularly know that well or you work with, and it goes from 0 to 60 very quickly because that's just how women can be and how open we can be with each other. That's just what I took from it. But yeah, it's Benton, and Benton basically says to her, yes, I do have an issue with, you know, I do have an issue. It's complicated. It's not as simple as you being white, me being black. And, there are many things. And I know there's a real sense of betrayal if somebody dates outside their race, or there's a sense of, you know, am I as a woman as a black woman, not enough for you? You have to go and seek right or wrong, whatever, you know, there's a big history of kind of also men, black men doing down black women and saying you're too hard and you're too difficult to be with. We're going to go date outside the race. It is complicated. It's not as simple as I like you and you like me for many, many reasons. And for somebody like Peter, who I think, I mean, I don't know if this is the first white woman he's ever even liked. You know, I don't know, but he just it feels like it's uncharted territory for him, and he's kind of freaking out a bit about it.
There's one thing now. What I think we'll probably discuss this more in upcoming episodes, but I know Eric LaSalle was the one who pushed for them not to. I mean, see, we're all basically nodding here, so we all know. Yeah, so he was the one that pushed for them not to end up in a relationship together. And I think part of it as well was that his previous relationship, because I think from the beginning, both he and Carla just said, I mean, we know what this is. Yeah. But his relationship with Jeannie was an adulterous relationship, yeah. Even though we know her marriage was over.
Yeah.
But she was still legally married. So I know LaSalle, and again, we'll discuss it going forward. He kind of wanted to go, well, he didn't want to have a controversial relationship. Right. And that's where I will do more reading on that before I imagine
what was probably going through his head is also, we rarely get to see functional black love, happy black love, and especially back then. There's something about not seeing black joy presented and not seeing black love represented and not seeing black queer love represented. You know, there's all these things. Yeah. And I think for him, he'd gone, oh, you've made me dysfunctional with all these black women. And we all have these stereotypes about, oh, black men leave and they're never happy. You know, I mean, I remember when the Stephen Lawrence case happened, which was a hideous thing over here in the UK. But people were really shocked that his parents were together and that they lived in a house and that they had other kids and they lived like basically what people would deem a white family as functional. Yeah. You know, that is how ingrained it is, this idea that black people, you know, aren't functional and don't know how to have relationships. So I think that's what it was that he was going for. He was going, well, why can't I be happy and model a happy black love, which totally get that. So that's kind of Benton in this whole thing. Mm. We can now rewind on Corday because she has quite a day at work, you know.
She does. We get not the first taste of, but I think we get Romano up to about 80% of what we can see Romano get up to, and it's not good.
No.
It's not. So it starts out, you know, these girls are brought in, they've got blood everywhere. I imagine this is part of the bloody mess. Blood everywhere, everybody's panicking. We learn she's doing the hemo-aid study in the ER, and so she's planning and getting, you know, hemo-aid down because these girls seem to have a lot of blood loss. Turns out they're actually, animal rights activists, and it's cow's blood that is on them. So, you know, it's a brilliant moment because they get rushed in and it starts out all like, you know, everybody's running down and being paged and it's all, you know, everybody at your stations, go, go, go. And then it's like, oh, there's nothing here. And everybody's kind of just standing around like, oh, okay. They've just
stand there shocked, like there's blood everywhere. Like, oh,
yeah.
But okay.
Not the right blood. And then we see, so we know that sets up the fact that Corday is using the hemo-aid. We get a scene with her in Green where Green's like, yep, happy to kind of be there to support this. We find out Romano doesn't know, which I'm sure will be fine that he doesn't know, because we all know that Romano's a very chill.
Yeah, he'd be like, oh, okay, yeah. that makes sense. Well done for taking the initiative. Yeah, well done.
So that's not going to blow up in her face at any point.
No, as we said,
you know, this gunshot wound victim comes in and he doesn't have family there to consent. So she says, actually, this will be a great chance to use the hemo blood, which is what she does. Romano finds out, he's downstairs for a completely different reason, sees the hemo blood, starts questioning Chuny, finds out actually, you know, Corday is using it. And we have a bit of a standoff where he kind of comes in and says, oh, you're using this blood. And, you know, it's very much pistols at dawn, isn't it? You know, you feel like, oh gosh, we're going to die here in this saloon as they stare at each other over the body.
And then
this is what he does, which is just, it's just so hideous, because you think at the end of the day, whatever your personal feelings are or your ego or any of that, how dare you go up to a patient's family and spread malicious.
Yeah.
You know, he basically riles the son up and says she used fake blood and we don't know anything about this fake blood. And, you know, she's basically treating your dad like he's less than. And I wonder if, you know, he played on the race thing with that because, you know, Mr. Chang's Chinese. And anyway, he basically sets that scene and then walks off and goes, here you go.
Such a scumbag kind of move.
It's revolting. Absolutely revolting.
There's a couple of things to it. One, of course, being it's a dick move to your colleague.
Yes.
Right. So why would you do that? But two, it's she needs people to be in her study. By doing that, he doesn't care who's on the bed. He doesn't care who he's standing beside. He's doing his absolute best to make sure people won't join her study,
yeah,
which means she'll have to, you know, in his mind, come crawling back to him. And then he thinks
it could really put his own work, you know. He doesn't seem to think about the fact that actually maybe this could get bigger and bigger and other people will turn around and go, we don't like this. And it might stop the HEMA blood or HEMA aid even being a thing because people have freaked out about it or heard about it and gone, let's shut this down early on. We don't want part of this, which he just doesn't. He's a man spurned. He basically, mm-hmm, he says to her, you know, forget doing it down in the ER. I will offer you this whole other thing where you basically get to coordinate it, you know, nationally or whatever. And it's basically the cheapest ploy ever to keep under his thumb. And says no. Oh, my gosh, she says no. How dare she?
Yeah, he creeps up on her as well. So it all feels part of this, like what he did last week with the negging, like giving her a rollicking and then giving her an opportunity. Yes. So she's she feels beholden to him and owes him because she's in trouble.
Exactly that. And I've had a really hideous experience in my life where a man has been very unhappy with how I have responded to things that he has done, and he made my life hell. So watching this was really like,
oh, was it triggery?
It was triggery, but it was also like, this is what it is. Like, yeah, you get some men who just have this tiny, you know, just have this ego that so easily bruised, so fragile. And how dare she do that to me? I have to find a way to own her and or destroy her. And it's horrible watching him kind of try and trap her under a glass dome. That's how I feel watching it.
Yeah.
You know,
and
this is where I'm like, thank God for Green, because he's just like, fine, that's fine. Yeah, yeah. I will support you. I will have your back. I will be there. And I'm just like, this is what you need. You need people like that to get you out of these toxic situations.
It's just an ego run rampant, isn't he? There's no self-control. I mean, he, by all accounts, he is a gifted surgeon. You know, he does great things medically, but as a human, oh, what a dumpster fire.
He's just hideous. Just... the whole thing is such an interesting case study to look at now past Me Too, where we can really understand a lot more about these things and how entwined she is in him. And it just reminds me of kind of, I don't know, like a man would marry a woman back in the day and, oh, well, I own you now because I have the money and you have no agency in the world and I'm going to control you because I'm giving you this, this and this. And it's so reminiscent of that, those horrible relationships, you know.
I'm probably about to cause an absolute riot of fanboys attacking us in the podcast, possibly, but that's what Elon Musk said to his first wife.
Oh, God, exactly.
At their wedding. Yeah, he's yeah.
It's out there so much. You get it with like those kind of, you know, especially with like, you know, with these tech boys where they think they're God. Basically, they've been told they're God. Romano's been told he's God because he's this surgeon.
Yeah.
You know, Ed Sheeran did the same thing with his girlfriend, who I think is now his wife. He would he'd test her, you know, take her to parties and leave her there to see how she would manage because sometimes he might be too busy. And he's happily will tell people that as if that's acceptable. And it just shows you how deep it goes in that I can own and I can control you. And
Neil's the reason I didn't like him.
Yeah, oh, he's a...
not just his bland music.
A bland music, bland person. Anyway. And good on Corday, because it's really tough to, you know, go against your master in, I guess, some ways. And she doesn't back down. She goes and she doubles down. And what's brilliant is actually the son, you know, the man wakes up, Mr. Chang wakes up and he wants to be part of the study. Yes. He's all for it. So she's got her first.
Wants to know more, wants to know else. Yeah,
yeah. He's obviously really thankful about it. And it's brilliant because it's like in your face, Romana, you know, she is going to do well and you can just fall on the side and die. I may be talking to somebody else and not Romano in this moment. Yeah. Anyway.
That's all right. I love there is a scene. Again, kind of like last week, I'm a glutton for any scenes between Mark and Corday make me smile. And there is, it's very, very short exchange down at the ER, the admin desk. And she tells him, nope, I'm going to stick with my study. And he's just like, good for you. Good for you. Yeah. Well, yeah. Meanwhile, we all know, like, this is going to explode. This is not going to end well.
Because one thing we know about, if you go against Romano, it's not like he's going to go, okay, that's fine, let's carry on.
It's a single battle in the war of attrition between the two. Oh. So the thing I remember from last week, because it is on this topic. So you remember that we were talking about the guy whose during the benzene episode, so it's even longer ago. So the guy who Romano's arms, he tries to save his arm, and you know Corday tries to save him. I feel like there's a foreshadowing of what happens to Romano later on, and how much support she gives.
Yeah.
She is unequivocal in her support of him, whatever he wants to do, and also gives him the facts about if he keeps his arm. Do you know what I mean? She's one of the few people who actually sticks with him right to the end.
She does. Mm. She's good. She's
because she's amazing.
She is amazing, but I also wonder how much of that is I've kicked you and so I have to.
Oh, okay.
I need to still continue to seek your approval on whatever level, no matter how strong and kick-ass you can be, those things are ingrained, unfortunately. So that's kind of, you know, Corday, she's basically, it's her versus Romano, and I'm sure all will end fine and we'll never hear anything other about it, but there you go. I think we should take a little walk into Carter's Corner. Who would like to join me?
I would definitely like to join you in Carter's Corner.
Thank you. When we first see Carter this morning, he's asleep at the table where they're all having breakfast, and we get the sense he's tired. Later we hear he's, you know, obviously suffering from insomnia and struggling with that. Obviously we see him and Benton. It's nice to see them together again and kind of working off each other. There is a moment though where Benton's basically talking to him about the woman and, you know, doing all these tests, and Carter has a bit of a moment of existential crisis where he's basically talking about how awful, like scary and horrible life is, and Benton just ignores him. And then we have a lovely moment between, because both Carter and Anna are going to give blood for this donation test, and they basically do each other, which is really sweet. And that's where Anna asks about Chase, and we get to reintroduce the idea of Chase again. You know, she wants to visit. Chase isn't ready yet. And then we actually get to see Chase at the end, which, you know, it's such a little delicate scene, but it's also really, it's tough, isn't it? Because none of us knew, the last time we all saw Chase, we knew that he wasn't going to wake up the same way, but we didn't know to what extent the damage would be.
Yeah, it's quite stark. Funnily enough, out of the whole episode, this is the scene that made me feel that some time has gone by.
Yes.
Because, like, obviously, Chase has woken up, been discharged, and been then admitted to a care home.
Yeah.
Where Carter has been coming to visit him often. You know, that kind of, obviously, we're so used to it in ER, but that feeling of, if you know the nurse on a first name basis, it means you go there a lot.
Yeah, exactly. It felt very much like a routine, didn't it? Oh, hi, oh, look, your cousin's here. Oh, look, he's brought you another book. It gives this idea of what's happened. So he's brought him a Walker Evans book, a book I have anyway. Walker Evans, very interesting photographer of kind of the early days of photography. Would take pictures of kind of everyday America that people are a bit like, whatever, but now you look back and you go, wow, you know, these pictures are amazing because it shows what the world was like and shows ordinary people, you know, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so he's brought him the Walker Evans book and they're looking through it, and we start to see, you know, Chase doesn't have very good motor functions. You know, he can't speak, he can't really do a lot. We don't know how much he's understanding about what's going on around him. He ends up spilling, you know, the water on himself and the book, and then he can't he can't change himself, and he gets frustrated. And it felt to me very much like what we were discussing previously in the episode, where Mark goes and watches his mom and sees his mom deteriorate, and how difficult from what you know what you're, that person is like. So Carter's obviously watching Chase, who's just, you know, nothing like what we knew him as.
I felt it was depicted really well as someone I have spent time with, you know, family members who are in an altered state and they're not going to get better, that it is uncomfortable. Mm. You know, everyone is trying to be so nice because it's nice to be nice. That's not it. But it's this idea of, you know, wanting to treat someone quote unquote normal, but knowing that your previous understanding of normal is not going to be your future understanding of normal in this case.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It is very, very hard. And I think it's done beautifully here, because particularly dropping the glass, that's I think kind of the crux of this scene. You know, he can't really hold a glass unsupervised or unaided. And
that's such a simple thing that we all just take for granted.
Of course, you know, and we change him into another shirt, and you know, like, he can't communicate in speech. So you can just see my enjoyment of this scene, commend to Jonathan Scarfe. I think he doesn't do a caricature. I don't feel he does a caricature of someone who is I use the term altered, maybe that's not the right term to use here, but I don't feel it's, you've seen in movies where they do, or they try and play people who have.
They talk about performing disability and kind of, you know, using able-bodied people to enact, and how it can be quite distressing and also quite uninformed and quite offensive. And
quite ableist as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this idea of, you know, somebody kind of gurning or kind of making those horrible sounds, and this is such a delicate scene, and like you say, I think that's what it is. It's the simplicity of it. You know, he spilt the water, which has had this effect, which has led him to be frustrated because he can't close his own button. And that made me think, actually, he's understanding more than he's able to communicate, which must be so
hideous. My nightmare. Absolutely my nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, Jonathan Scarfe, as you're saying, Sean, played an absolute blinder on this one. Like, the levels within it of, he knows that it's not right, and he's, as you say, frustration of, I'm not, this is where I am, or this isn't who I am. And it was heartbreaking, as you say. It's a beautiful scene. Again, it's that beauty and pain that Sharon mentioned.
And I think what I'd like to just say is, I agree with you guys. Like, I watched it and I thought this is really beautifully handled, but my privilege is I am an able-bodied person, and I don't know how somebody who isn't might view this, absolutely, or might have a different take absolutely on it. But I guess for the moment, that's just how we feel about it. And that's where it kind of ends, which is, you know, really heartbreaking. And it's really, and again, you know, we haven't seen much of Carter in this episode, which is just, you know, how I feel about when that happens.
Well, that is true.
It is a crime.
So it's a terrible episode, is what you're saying.
Hideous. What's the point?
Of course.
Strike it from the record.
But, you know, he's still having to do a lot for this. Scene must be, I feel for him as the actor, because he's had some really draining episodes recently. And this is a small scene, but I still think a really draining, tough scene. And props to him. But that's the episode.
It is. I will say for myself, I don't have any Ivers. I was looking.
I've got one.
Oh, great. Okay.
Go for it.
So one of the girls who's brought in at the beginning with the blood on her, apparently her name was Claire in the episode. She's played by a lady called Nicole Bilderbeck, who you might recognise from things like Bring It On, Can't Hardly Wait. She's been in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Dawson's Creek, Bones, Buffy, and The Fresh Prince. She's been around, but she was in a lot of kind of the teen stuff of late 90s, early noughties kind of films and TV shows.
I recognise one of those girls. The Southeast Asian girl, she was sat next.
Yeah, that's Nicole Bilderbeck.
Oh, is that it? Thank you. Because I looked through the IMDb and I couldn't spot the name or anything. And I did, but yeah, her neck, I was like, that's, I know, I've seen her.
Yes, yeah.
Thank that's you. Okay. I've got Morgan Nagler, who played Natalie, who's the girlfriend of her teacher.
Okay, yeah.
and it's funny, it's one of those where I definitely recognise her from something, and she's been in quite a lot of stuff, but there's no one show or film I go, that's it. She's an American Pie 2 and Evolution, which I know I've seen a couple of times. It's got David Duchovny in it. But also,
late Ivan Reitman directed that.
Yeah, listened to another Marc Maron interview. Like he's re-released their interview from 2014, and he just sounds amazing. But she was also in, this is one for me and Sean, I'm afraid. She was kid number one in the Star Trek TNG episode Rascals.
I know her well.
Don't say that. That's joking.
Not even a little bit.
Oh, brilliant. She was also in Diagnosis Murder, American Pie 2. She's in Frasier as Christy. As I'm having a Frasier rewatch, I look forward to that and forgetting all about it by the time I get around to it.
Lovely.
And she's been in quite a few music videos, and she's a musician herself as well.
Great.
Very cool.
So do you want to do drugs? Because you've been so good lately.
Well, sure. Listen, if things are going that way.
So it's actually quite an odd one, because you mentioned about when Morgan Stern jabs that fella in the stomach and then mentioned they're giving him bicarbonate of soda.
Yes.
I'm trying to think, really? Because that's also called baking powder, right?
Yeah.
It's what you use to make cakes. You know, your cakes fluffy. Yeah. But it's also used, as they did with this chap, for heartburn. So, because it's an alkali, it balances out the acid reflux. So that's part of the whole thing with this chap. But it's got loads of other uses. It's, amazing, really. If you do use it too much, it can cause a thing called metabolic alkalosis, in which your blood becomes too alkaline and also causes heart problems. And it is very high in sodium as well, so you've got to be careful. It's also, you can use it on mouth ulcers, possibly.
Yes, actually, I know that to be true.
Did you? Oh, okay.
I get mouth ulcers very often. Yeah. I just need a new face. Anyway, you were saying?
I like your face.
Thank you.
Keep it.
Yeah, all right, then.
It's also used as a supplement for athletes.
Ooh.
So when you're working out during high intensity exercise, your muscle produces lactic acid, which is why you get that burning feeling when you work it out. But if you also, lactic acid also lowers the pH inside of your cells, which potentially can cause your muscles to tire. Because baking soda is high alkaline, it can balance that out. So it can delay fatigue.
Ooh.
You know, it can delay those, symptoms of fatigue by basically just being, a base to the acid. I think I've got that wrong way around, possibly. But yeah, it's... Also can relieve itchy skin and sunburns.
Oh, it's one of those that you can,
does
more than you think it does.
But may slow the progression of chronic kidney disease. It may improve certain cancer treatments, which is still early days. They've not, apparently, as of writing of this article, thank you, healthline.com, it's still... the evidence limited to test tube studies and animal studies. So, but yeah, some research shows that baking soda may help chemotherapy medicines work more effectively by making the environment for tumors less acidic.
Okay, actually, that sparks a memory of this episode from the beginning of the episode where Corday comes down with the HemoAid, and one of the protester girls, the first thing she says is, "Was it tested on animals?"
Yes,
and Corday says, "Yes, I believe it was."
Yeah,
and I suppose so many medical products must be.
Yeah. And it's not,
I mean, it's a it,
perfect,
I think,
and it's not great.
Yeah, absolutely. And anyway, sorry. It's a plot point in a film, and I was just going to bring it up, then I thought, who cares? Carry on.
Oh, tell us.
We like films.
It's just driving me crazy with Melissa Joan Hart and Adrian Grenier, and he's got a girlfriend who's very kind of protesty and against a lot of things. And she kind of gets mad at him at one point because he's, not speaking out about animal are kind of against animal things, and Melissa Joan Hart takes the girlfriend aside, says, you know, his mom died of cancer and a lot of those treatments were. And that's one of the things that just made me go, hang on a minute. It's one of those, we kind of go black and white, but actually are there nuances? Yeah. Because I really love that cancer treatments are out there, you know, so.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. Something definitely food for thought, which it's ER, it'll come up again.
Food for thought, bicarbonate of soda. That's a connection as well. I was thinking about cake.
Well, actually, I'll tell you what, let's go get some cake. And yes. On that, let's call it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about everything ER and cake. Don't forget, you can find us on social media on Instagram at YouSetTheTonePod and at @set_pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember, you set the tone.